Cho's hand was lying on the table beside her coffee, and how he was feeling a mounting pressure to take hold of it.
"Just do it,"
he told himself, as a fount of mingled panic and excitement surged up inside his chest.
"Just reach out and grab it."
Amazing how much more difficult it was to extend his arm 12 inches and touch her hand than to snatch a speeding snitch from midair. But just as he moved his hand forward, Cho took hers off the table. She was now watching Roger Davis kissing his girlfriend with a mildly interested expression.
"He asked me out, you know," she said in a quiet voice, "a couple of weeks ago, Roger. I turned him down, though."
Harry, who had grabbed the sugar bowl to excuse his sudden lunging movement across the table, could not think why she was telling him this. If she wished she was sitting at the table next door being heartily kissed by Roger Davis, why had she agreed to come out with him? He said nothing. Their cherub threw another handful of confetti over them. Some of it landed in the last cold dregs of coffee Harry had been about to drink.
"I came in here with Cedric last year," said Cho.
In the seconds or so it took for him to take in what she had said, Harry's insides had become glacial. He could not believe she wanted to talk about Cedric now, while kissing couples surrounded them and a cherub floated over their heads. Cho's voice was rather higher when she spoke again.
"I've been meaning to ask you for ages. Did he mention me at all before he died?"
This was the very last subject on earth Harry wanted to discuss, and least of all with Cho.
"Well, no," he said quietly. There wasn't time for him to say anything. So, do you
get to see a lot of Quidditch in the holidays? You support the Tornadoes, right?" His voice sounded falsely bright and cheery. To his horror, he saw that her eyes were swimming with tears again, just as they had been after the last DA meeting before Christmas.
"Look,"
he said desperately, leaning in so that nobody else could overhear.
"Let's not talk about Cedric right now. Let's talk about something else."
But this apparently was quite the wrong thing to say.
"I thought," she said, tears spattering down onto the table, "I thought you'd understand. I need to talk about it. Surely you need to talk about it, too. I mean, you saw it happened, didn't you?"
Everything was going nightmarishly wrong. Roger Davis's girlfriend had even unglued herself to look around at Cho crying.
"Well, I have talked about it," Harry said in a whisper, "to Ron and Hermione, but..." "Oh, you'll talk to Hermione Granger?"
she said shrilly, her face now shining with tears, and several more kissing couples broke apart to stare.
"But you won't talk to me. Perhaps it would be best if we just paid, and you went and met up with Hermione Granger, like you obviously want to."
Harry stared at her, utterly bewildered, as she seized a frilly napkin and dabbed at her shining face with it.
"Cho?"
he said weakly, wishing Roger would seize his girlfriend and start kissing her again to stop her goggling at him and Cho.
"Go on, leave," she said, now crying into the napkin. "I don't know why you asked me out in the first place if you're going to make arrangements to meet other girls right after me. How many are you meeting after Hermione?"
"It's not like that," said Harry, and he was so relieved at finally understanding what she was annoyed about that he laughed, which he realized a split second too late was a mistake. Cho sprang to her feet. The whole tea room was quiet, and everybody was watching them now.
"I'll see you around, Harry,"
she said dramatically, and hiccuping slightly, she dashed to the door, wrenched it open, and hurried off into the pouring rain.
"Cho!"
Harry called after her, but the door had already swung shut behind her with a tuneful tinkle. There was total silence within the tea shop. Every eye was upon Harry. He threw a galleon down onto the table, shook pink confetti out of his eyes, and followed Cho out of the door. It was raining hard now, and she was nowhere to be seen. He simply did not understand what had happened. Half an hour ago they had been getting along fine.
"Women,"
he muttered angrily, sloshing down the rain-washed street with his hands in his pockets. What did she want to talk about Cedric for, anyway? Why does she always want to drag up a subject that makes her act like a human hosepipe? He turned right and broke into a splashy run, and within minutes he was turning into the doorway of the Three Broomsticks. He knew he was too early to meet Hermione, but he thought it likely there would be someone in here with whom he could spend the intervening time. He shook his wet hair out of his eyes and looked around. Hagrid was sitting alone in a corner, looking morose.
"Hi, Hagrid,"
he said, when he had squeezed through the crammed tables and pulled up a chair beside him. Hagrid jumped and looked down at Harry as though he barely recognized him. Harry saw that he had two fresh cuts on his face and several new bruises.
"Oh, it's you, Harry," said Hagrid. "You all right?"
"Yeah, I'm fine," lied Harry. In fact, next to this battered and mournful-looking Hagrid, he felt he did not have much to complain about. "Are you okay?"
"Me?"
said Hagrid.
"Oh, yeah, I'm grand, Harry. Grand."
He gazed into the depths of his pewter tankard, which was the size of a large bucket, and sighed. Harry did not know what to say to him. They sat side by side in silence for a moment. Then Hagrid said abruptly,
"In the same boat, you and me, aren't we, Harry?"
Said Harry.
"Yeah, I've said it before. Both outsiders, like,"
said Hagrid, nodding wisely.
"And both orphans. Yeah, both orphans."
He took a great swig from his tankard.
"Makes a difference, having a decent family,"
he said.
"Me dad was decent, and your mum and dad were decent. If they'd lived, life would have been different, eh?"
"Yeah, I suppose," said Harry cautiously. Hagrid seemed to be in a very strange mood.
"Family,"
said Hagrid gloomily.
"Whatever you say, blood's important."
And he wiped a trickle of it out of his eye. "Hagrid," said Harry, unable to stop himself, "where are you getting all these injuries?"
"Eh?"
said Hagrid, looking startled.
"What injuries?"
"All those," said Harry, pointing at Hagrid's face.
"Oh, that's just normal bumps and bruises, Harry,"
said Hagrid dismissively.
"I got a rough job."
He drained his tankard, set it back upon the table, and got to his feet.
"I'll be seeing you, Harry. Take care now."
And he lumbered out of the pub looking wretched, and then disappeared into the torrential rain. Harry watched him go, feeling miserable. Hagrid was unhappy and he was hiding something, but he seemed determined not to accept help. What was going on? But before Harry could think about the matter any further, he heard a voice calling his name.
"Harry! Harry, over here!"
Hermione was waving at him from the other side of the room. He got up and made his way toward her through the crowded pub. He was still a few tables away when he realized that Hermione was not alone. She was sitting at a table with the unlikeliest pair of drinking mates he could ever have imagined. Luna Lovegood, and none other than Rita Skeeter, ex-journalist on the Daily Prophet and one of Hermione's least favorite people in the world.
"You're early,"
said Hermione, moving along to give him room to sit down.
"I thought you were with Cho. I wasn't expecting you for another hour, at least."
"Cho?"
said Rita at once, twisting around in her seat to stare avidly at Harry.
"A girl?"
She snatched up her crocodile skin handbag and groped within it.
"It's none of your business if Harry's been with 100 girls,"
Hermione told Rita coolly.
"So you can put that away right now."
Rita had been on the point of withdrawing an acid green quill from her bag. Looking as though she had been forced to swallow stink sap, she snapped her bag shut again.
"What are you up to?"
Harry asked, sitting down and staring from Rita to Luna to Hermione.
"Little Miss Perfect was just about to tell me when you arrived,"
said Rita, taking a large slurp of her drink.
"I suppose I'm allowed to talk to him, am I?"
she shot at Hermione.
"Yes, I suppose you are,"
said Hermione coldly. Unemployment did not suit Rita. The hair that had once been set in elaborate curls now hung lank and unkempt around her face. The scarlet paint on her 2-inch talons was chipped, and there were a couple of false jewels missing from her winged glasses. She took another great gulp of her drink and said out of the corner of her mouth,
"Pretty girl, is she, Harry?"
"One more word about Harry's love life and the deal's off, and that's a promise,"
said Hermione irritably.
"What deal?"
said Rita, wiping her mouth on the back of her hand.
"You haven't mentioned a deal yet, Miss Prissy. You just told me to turn up. Oh, one of these days."
She took a deep, shuddering breath.
"Yes, yes, one of these days you'll write more horrible stories about Harry and me," said Hermione indifferently. "Find someone who cares. Why don't you? They've run plenty of horrible stories about Harry this year without my help,"
said Rita, shooting a sideways look at him over the top of her glass and adding in a rough whisper,
"How has that made you feel, Harry? Betrayed, distraught, misunderstood?"
"He feels angry, of course," said Hermione in a hard, clear voice.
because he's told the Minister of Magic the truth, and the Minister's too much of an idiot to believe him. So, you actually stick to it, do you? That he who must not be named is back?
Said Rita, lowering her glass and subjecting Harry to a piercing stare, while her fingers strayed longingly to the clasp of the crocodile bag.
You stand by all this garbage Dumbledore's been telling everybody about you-know-who returning, and you being the sole witness?
I wasn't the sole witness, snarled Harry. There were a dozen odd Death Eaters there as well. Want their names?
I'd love them,
breathed Rita, now fumbling in her bag once more and gazing at him as though he was the most beautiful thing she had ever seen.
A great bold headline. Potter accuses. A subheading. Harry Potter names Death Eaters still among us. And then, beneath a nice big photograph of you, disturbed teenage survivor of you-know-who's attack, Harry Potter 15, caused outrage yesterday by accusing respectable and prominent members of the wizarding community of being Death Eaters.
The quick quotes quill was actually in her hand and halfway to her mouth when the rapturous expression died out of her face.
But of course, she said, lowering the quill and looking daggers at Hermione, little Miss Perfect wouldn't want that story out there, would she?
As a matter of fact, said Hermione sweetly, that's exactly what little Miss Perfect does want. Rita stared at her. So did Harry. Luna, on the other hand, sang,
Weasley is our king,
dreamily under her breath, and stirred her drink with a cocktail onion on a stick.
You want me to report what he says about he who must not be named?
Rita asked Hermione in a hushed voice.
Yes, I do, said Hermione. The true story, all the facts, exactly as Harry reports them. He'll give you all the details. He'll tell you the names of the undiscovered Death Eaters he saw there. He'll tell you what Voldemort looks like now. Oh, get a grip on yourself!
She added contemptuously, throwing a napkin across the table, for at the sound of Voldemort's name, Rita had jumped so badly that she had slopped half her glass of fire whiskey down herself. Rita blotted the front of her grubby raincoat, still staring at Hermione. Then she said baldly,
The Prophet wouldn't print it. In case you haven't noticed, nobody believes his cock and bull story. Everyone thinks he's delusional. Now, if you'll let me write the story from that angle...
We don't need another story about how Harry's lost his marbles, said Hermione angrily.
We've had plenty of those already, thank you. I want him given the opportunity to tell the truth. There's no market for a story like that, said Rita coldly. You mean the Prophet won't print it because Fudge won't let them,
said Hermione irritably. Rita gave Hermione a long, hard look. Then, leaning forward across the table toward her, she said, in a businesslike tone,
All right, Fudge is leaning on the Prophet, but it comes to the same thing. They won't print a story that shows Harry in a good light. Nobody wants to read it. It's against the public mood. This last Azkaban breakout has got people quite worried enough. People just don't want to believe you-know-who's back.
So the Daily Prophet exists to tell people what they want to hear, does it? Said Hermione scathingly. Rita sat up straight again, her eyebrows raised, and drained her glass of fire whiskey.
The Prophet exists to sell itself, you silly girl, she said coldly. My dad thinks it's an awful paper, said Luna, chipping into the conversation unexpectedly.
Sucking on her cocktail onion, she gazed at Rita with her enormous, protuberant, slightly mad eyes.
He publishes important stories that he thinks the public needs to know. He doesn't care about making money.
Rita looked disparagingly at Luna.
I'm guessing your father runs some stupid little village newsletter, she said. 25 ways to mingle with muggles and the dates of the next Bring and Fly sale. No, said Luna, dipping her onion back into her gilly water. He's the editor of The Quibbler.
Rita snorted so loudly that people at a nearby table looked around in alarm.
Important stories he thinks the public needs to know, she said witheringly. I could manure my garden with the contents of that rag. Well, this is your chance to raise the tone of it a bit, isn't it? Said Hermione pleasantly. Luna says her father's quite happy to take Harry's interview. That's who'll be publishing it.
Rita stared at them both for a moment, and then let out a great whoop of laughter.
The Quibbler, she said, cackling. You think people would take him seriously if he's published in The Quibbler?
Some people won't, said Hermione in a level voice.
But the Daily Prophet's version of the Azkaban breakout had some gaping holes in it. I think a lot of people will be wondering whether there isn't a better explanation of what happened, and if there's an alternative story available, even if it is published in a...
She glanced sideways at Luna.
In a, well, an unusual magazine. I think they might be rather keen to read it.
Rita did not say anything for a while, but eyed Hermione shrewdly, her head a little to one side.
All right, let's say for a moment I'll do it, she said abruptly. What kind of fee am I going to get?
I don't think Daddy exactly pays people to write for the magazine, said Luna dreamily. They do it because it's an honor, and, of course, to see their names in print.
Rita Skeeter looked as though the taste of stink sap was strong in her mouth again as she rounded on Hermione.
I'm supposed to do this for free? Well, yes, said Hermione calmly, taking a sip of her drink. Otherwise, as you very well know, I will inform the authorities that you are an unregistered animagus. Of course, the prophet might give you rather a lot for an insider's account of life in Azkaban.
Rita looked as though she would have liked nothing better than to seize the paper umbrella sticking out of Hermione's drink and thrust it up her nose.
I don't suppose I've got any choice, have I?
Said Rita, her voice shaking slightly. She opened her crocodile bag once more, withdrew a piece of parchment, and raised her quick quotes quill.
Daddy will be pleased, said Luna brightly. A muscle twitched in Rita's jaw. Okay, Harry, said Hermione, turning to him. Ready to tell the public the truth?
I suppose, said Harry, watching Rita balancing the quick quotes quill at the ready on the parchment between them.
Fire away then, Rita, said Hermione serenely, fishing a cherry out of the bottom of her glass.
Chapter 26 Seen and Unforeseen. Luna said vaguely that she did not know how soon Rita's interview with Harry would appear in the Quibbler, that her father was expecting a lovely long article on recent sightings of Crumplehorn Snorkaks.
And, of course, that'll be a very important story. So Harry's might have to wait for the following issue, said Luna.
Harry had not found it an easy experience to talk about the night when Voldemort had returned. Rita had pressed him for every little detail, and he had given her everything he could remember, knowing that this was his one big opportunity to tell the world the truth. He wondered how people would react to the story. He guessed that it would confirm a lot of people in the view that he was completely insane, not least because his story would be appearing alongside utter rubbish about Crumplehorn Snorkaks. But the breakout of Bellatrix Lestrange and her fellow Death Eaters had given Harry a burning desire to do something, whether it worked or not.
"Can't wait to see what Umbridge thinks of your going public,"
said Dean, sounding awestruck at dinner on Monday night. Seamus was shoveling down large amounts of chicken and ham pie on Dean's other side, but Harry knew he was listening.
"It's the right thing to do, Harry,"
said Neville, who was sitting opposite him. He was rather pale, but went on in a low voice.
"It must have been tough talking about it, was it?"
"Yeah," mumbled Harry, "but people have got to know what Voldemort's capable of, haven't they?"
"That's right," said Neville, nodding. "And his Death Eaters, too. People should know."
Neville left his sentence hanging and returned to his baked potato. Seamus looked up, but when he caught Harry's eye, he looked quickly back at his plate again. After a while, Dean, Seamus, and Neville departed for the common room, leaving Harry and Hermione at the table waiting for Ron, who had not yet had dinner because of Quidditch practice. Cho Chang walked into the hall with her friend Marietta. Harry's stomach gave an unpleasant lurch, but she did not look over at the Gryffindor table and sat down with her back to him.
"Oh, I forgot to ask you," said Hermione brightly, glancing over at the Ravenclaw table. "What happened on your date with Cho? How come you were back so early?"
"Well, it was," said Harry, pulling a dish of rhubarb crumble toward him and helping himself to seconds. "A complete fiasco, now you mention it." And he told her what had happened in Madame Puddyfoot's tea shop.
"So then," he finished several minutes later, as the final bit of crumble disappeared. "She jumps up, right, and says, 'I'll see you around, Harry,' and runs out of the place."
He put down his spoon and looked at Hermione.
"I mean, what was all that about? What was going on?"
Hermione glanced over at the back of Cho's head and sighed.
"Oh, Harry," she said sadly. "Well, I'm sorry, but you were a bit tactless."
"Me? Tactless?" said Harry, outraged.
One minute we were getting on fine. Next minute she was telling me that Roger Davis asked her out and how she used to go and snog Cedric in that stupid tea shop. How was I supposed to feel about that?
Well, you see, said Hermione, with the patient air of one explaining that 1 + 1 = 2 to an over-emotional toddler. You shouldn't have told her that you wanted to meet me halfway through your date.
But, spluttered Harry, but you told me to meet you at 12 and to bring her along. How was I supposed to do that without telling her?
You should have told her differently, said Hermione, still with that maddeningly patient air. You should have said it was really annoying, but I'd made you promise to come along to the Three Broomsticks, and you really didn't want to go. You'd much rather spend the whole day with her, but unfortunately you thought you really ought to meet me, and would she please, please come along with you, and hopefully you'd be able to get away more quickly. And it might have been a good idea to mention how ugly you think I am, too.
Hermione added as an afterthought. But I don't think you're ugly, said Harry, bemused.
Hermione laughed. Harry, you're worse than Ron. Well, no, you're not, she sighed, as Ron came stumping into the hall, splattered with mud and looking grumpy. Look, you upset Cho when you said you were going to meet me, so she tried to make you jealous. It was her way of trying to find out how much you liked her.
Is that what she was doing? Said Harry, as Ron dropped onto the bench opposite them and pulled every dish within reach toward himself.
Well, wouldn't it have been easier if she'd just asked me whether I liked her better than you?
Girls don't often ask questions like that, said Hermione.
Well, they should, said Harry forcefully. Then I could have just told her I fancy her, and she wouldn't have had to get herself all worked up again about Cedric dying.
I'm not saying what she did was sensible,
said Hermione, as Ginny joined them, just as muddy as Ron, and looking equally disgruntled.
I'm just trying to make you see how she was feeling at the time.
You should write a book, Ron told Hermione as he cut up his potatoes. Translating mad things girls do so boys can understand them.
Yeah,
said Harry fervently, looking over at the Ravenclaw table. Cho had just got up. Still not looking at him, she left the great hall. Feeling rather depressed, he looked back at Ron and Ginny.
So, how was Quidditch practice?
It was a nightmare, said Ron in a surly voice.
Oh, come on, said Hermione, looking at Ginny. I'm sure it wasn't that.
Yes, it was, said Ginny. It was appalling.
Angelina was nearly in tears by the end of it.
Ron and Ginny went off for baths after dinner. Harry and Hermione returned to the busy Gryffindor common room and their usual pile of homework. Harry had been struggling with a new star chart for astronomy for half an hour when Fred and George turned up.
"Ron and Ginny not here?"
asked Fred, looking around as he pulled up a chair, and when Harry shook his head, he said,
"Good. We were watching their practice. They're going to be slaughtered. They're complete rubbish without us."
"Come on, Ginny's not bad," said George fairly, sitting down next to Fred.
Actually, I don't know how she got so good, seeing how we never let her play with us.
She's been breaking into your broom shed in the garden since the age of 6 and taking each of your brooms out in turn when you weren't looking,
said Hermione from behind her tottering pile of ancient rune books.
Oh, said George, looking mildly impressed. Well, that'd explain it.
Has Ron saved a goal yet?
Asked Hermione, peering over the top of magical hieroglyphs and logograms.
Well, he can do it if he doesn't think anyone's watching him, said Fred, rolling his eyes.
So all we have to do is ask the crowd to turn their backs and talk among themselves every time the quaffle goes up his end on Saturday.
He got up again and moved restlessly to the window, staring out across the dark grounds.
You know, Quidditch was about the only thing in this place worth staying for.
Hermione cast him a stern look.
You've got exams coming.
Told you already, we're not fussed about any WTs, said Fred. The snack boxes are ready to roll. We found out how to get rid of those boils. Just a couple of drops of myrtlap essence sorts them. Lee put us on to it.
George yawned widely and looked out disconsolately at the cloudy night sky.
I don't know if I even want to watch this match. If Zachariah Smith beats us, I might have to kill myself.
Kill him, more like, said Fred firmly.
That's the trouble with Quidditch,
said Hermione absent-mindedly, once again bent over her rune translation.
It creates all this bad feeling and tension between the houses.
She looked up to find her copy of Spellman's syllabary,
and caught Fred, George, and Harry looking at her with expressions of mingled disgust and incredulity on their faces.
"Well, it does," she said impatiently. "It's only a game, isn't it?"
"Hermione," said Harry, shaking his head, "you're good on feelings and stuff, but you just don't understand about Quidditch."
"Maybe not," she said darkly, returning to her translation again. "But at least my happiness doesn't depend on Ron's goalkeeping ability."
And though Harry would rather have jumped off the astronomy tower than admit it to her, by the time he had watched the game the following Saturday, he would have given any number of galleons not to care about Quidditch either. The very best thing you could say about the match was that it was short. The Gryffindor spectators had to endure only 22 minutes of agony. It was hard to say what the worst thing was. Harry thought it was a close-run contest between Ron's 14th failed save, Sloper missing the bludger but hitting Angelina in the mouth with his bat, and Kirk shrieking as Zacharias Smith zoomed at him carrying the quaffle and falling backward off his broom. The miracle was that Gryffindor only lost by 10 points. Ginny managed to snatch the snitch from right under Hufflepuff Seeker Summerbee's nose so that the final score was 240 versus 230.
"Good catch," Harry told Ginny back in the common room, where the atmosphere closely resembled that of a particularly dismal funeral. "I was lucky," she shrugged. "It wasn't a very fast snitch, and Summerbee's got a cold. He sneezed and closed his eyes at exactly the wrong moment. Anyway, once you're back on the team..."
"Ginny, I've got a lifelong ban."
"You're banned as long as Umbridge is in the school," Ginny corrected him. "There's a difference. Anyway, once you're back, I think I'll try out for Chaser. Angelina and Alicia are both leaving next year, and I prefer goal scoring to seeking anyway."
Harry looked over at Ron, who was hunched in a corner, staring at his knees, a bottle of butterbeer clutched in his hand.
"Angelina still won't let him resign," Ginny said, as though reading Harry's mind. "She says she knows he's got it in him."
Harry liked Angelina for the faith she was showing in Ron, but at the same time thought it would really be kinder to let him leave the team. Ron had left the pitch to another booming chorus of "Weasley is our king," sung with great gusto by the Slytherins, who were now favourites to win the Quidditch Cup. Fred and George wandered over.
"I haven't got the heart to take the mickey out of him even," said Fred, looking over at Ron's crumpled figure. "Mind you, when he missed the 14th,
he made wild motions with his arms as though doing an upright doggy paddle.
"Well, I'll save it for parties, eh?"
Ron dragged himself up to bed shortly after this. Out of respect for his feelings, Harry waited a while before going up to the dormitory himself, so that Ron could pretend to be asleep if he wanted to. Sure enough, when Harry finally entered the room, Ron was snoring a little too loudly to be entirely plausible. Harry got into bed thinking about the match. It had been immensely frustrating watching from the sidelines. He was quite impressed by Ginny's performance, but he felt that if he had been playing, he could have caught the snitch sooner. There had been a moment when it had been fluttering near Kirk's ankle. If she hadn't hesitated, she might have been able to scrape a win for Gryffindor. Umbridge had been sitting a few rows below Harry and Hermione. Once or twice she had turned squatly in her seat to look at him, her wide toad's mouth stretched in what he thought had been a gloating smile. The memory of it made him feel hot with anger as he lay there in the dark. After a few moments, however, he remembered that he was supposed to be emptying his mind of all emotion before he slept, as Snape kept instructing him at the end of every occlumency lesson. He tried for a moment or two, but the thought of Snape, on top of memories of Umbridge, merely increased his sense of grumbling resentment, and he found himself focusing instead on how much he loathed the pair of them. Slowly Ron's snores died away, replaced by the sound of deep, slow breathing. It took Harry much longer to get to sleep. His body was tired, but it took his brain a long time to close down. He dreamed that Neville and Professor Sprout were waltzing around the Room of Requirement, while Professor McGonagall played the bagpipes. He watched them happily for a while, then decided to go and find the other members of the DA. But when he left the room, he found himself facing not the tapestry of Barnabas the Barmy, but a torch burning in its bracket on a stone wall. He turned his head slowly to the left. There, at the far end of the windowless passage, was a plain black door. He walked toward it with a sense of mounting excitement. He had the strangest feeling that this time he was going to get lucky at last and find the way to open it. He was feet from it and saw, with a leap of excitement, that there was a glowing strip of faint blue light down the right-hand side. The door was ajar. He stretched out his hand to push it wide, and Ron gave a loud rasp in genuine snore, and Harry awoke abruptly, with his right hand stretched in front of him in the darkness, to open a door that was hundreds of miles away. He let it fall with a feeling of mingled disappointment and guilt. He knew he should not have seen the door, but at the same time felt so consumed with curiosity about what was behind it that he could not help feeling annoyed with Ron. If he could have saved his snore for just another minute. They entered the great hall for breakfast at exactly the same moment as the post owls on Monday morning. Hermione was not the only person eagerly awaiting her daily profit. Nearly everyone was eager for more news about the escaped Death Eaters who, despite many reported sightings, had still not been caught. She gave the delivery owl a canut and unfolded the newspaper eagerly while Harry helped himself to orange juice. And as he had only received one note during the entire year, he was sure when the first owl landed with a thud in front of him that it had made a mistake. "Who are you after?" he asked it, languidly removing his orange juice from underneath its beak and leaning forward to see the recipient's name and address. "Harry Potter, Great Hall, Hogwarts School." Frowning, he made to take the letter from the owl, but before he could do so, 3, 4, 5 more owls had fluttered down beside it and were jockeying for position, treading in the butter, knocking over the salt, and each attempting to give him their letters first. "What's going on?" Ron asked in amazement as the whole of Gryffindor table leaned forward to watch as another 7 owls landed among the first ones, screeching, hooting, and flapping their wings. "Harry!" said Hermione breathlessly, plunging her hands into the feathery mass and pulling out a screech owl bearing a long cylindrical package. "I think I know what this means. Open this one first." Harry ripped off the brown packaging. Out rolled a tightly furled copy of March's edition of The Quibbler. He unrolled it to see his own face grinning sheepishly at him from the front cover. In large red letters across his picture were the words, "Harry Potter speaks out at last, the truth about he who must not be named and the night I saw him return."
"It's good, isn't it?"
said Luna, who had drifted over to the Gryffindor table and now squeezed herself onto the bench between Fred and Ron.
"It came out yesterday. I asked Dad to send you a free copy. I expect all these."
She waved a hand at the assembled owls still scrabbling around on the table in front of Harry.
"Are letters from readers." "That's what I thought," said Hermione eagerly. "Harry, do you mind if we—"
"Help yourself," said Harry, feeling slightly bemused. Ron and Hermione both started ripping open envelopes.
"This one's from a bloke who thinks you're off your rocker," said Ron, glancing down his letter. "Ah, well, this woman recommends you try a good course of shock spells at St. Mungo's," said Hermione, looking disappointed and crumpling up a second.
"This one looks okay, though," said Harry slowly, scanning a long letter from a witch in Paisley.
"Hey, she says she believes me."
"This one's in two minds," said Fred, who had joined in the letter opening with enthusiasm. "Says you don't come across as a mad person, but he really doesn't want to believe you know who's back, so he doesn't know what to think now."
"Blimey, what a waste of parchment." "Here's another one you've convinced, Harry," said Hermione excitedly. "Having read your side of the story, I am forced to the conclusion that the Daily Prophet has treated you very unfairly. Little though I want to think that he who must not be named has returned, I am forced to accept that you are telling the truth. Oh, this is wonderful."
"Another one who thinks you're barking," said Ron, throwing a crumpled letter over his shoulder.
"But this one says you've got her converted, and she now thinks you're a real hero. She's put in a photograph, too."
"Wow! What is going on here?"
said a falsely sweet, girlish voice. Harry looked up with his hands full of envelopes. Professor Umbridge was standing behind Fred and Luna, her bulging toad's eyes scanning the mess of owls and letters on the table in front of Harry. Behind her, he saw many of the students watching them avidly.
"Why have you got all these letters, Mr. Potter?"
she asked slowly.
"Is that a crime now?" said Fred loudly. "Getting mail?"
"Be careful, Mr. Weasley, or I shall have to put you in detention," said Umbridge. "Well, Mr. Potter?"
Harry hesitated, but he did not see how he could keep what he had done quiet. It was surely only a matter of time before a copy of The Quibbler came to Umbridge's attention. "People have written to me because I gave an interview," said Harry, "about what happened to me last June." For some reason, he glanced up at the staff table as he said this. He had the strangest feeling that Dumbledore had been watching him a second before, but when he looked, Dumbledore seemed to be absorbed in conversation with Professor Flitwick.
"An interview?"
repeated Umbridge, her voice thinner and higher than ever.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean a reporter asked me questions, and I answered them," said Harry. "Here." And he threw the copy of the Quibbler at her. She caught it and stared down at the cover. Her pale, doughy face turned an ugly, patchy violet.
"When did you do this?"
she asked, her voice trembling slightly. "Last Hogsmeade weekend," said Harry. She looked at him, incandescent with rage, the magazine shaking in her stubby fingers.
"There will be no more Hogsmeade trips for you, Mr. Potter," she whispered. "How you dare, how you could."
She took a deep breath.
"I have tried again and again to teach you not to tell lies. The message apparently has still not sunk in. 50 points from Gryffindor and another week's worth of detentions."
She stalked away, clutching the Quibbler to her chest, the eyes of many students following her. By mid-morning, enormous signs had been put up all over the school, not just on house notice boards, but in the corridors and classrooms too. "By order of the High Inquisitor of Hogwarts, any student found in possession of the magazine The Quibbler will be expelled. The above is in accordance with Educational Decree No. 27, signed Dolores Jane Umbridge, High Inquisitor." For some reason, every time Hermione caught sight of one of these signs, she beamed with pleasure. "What exactly are you so happy about?" Harry asked her.
"Oh, Harry, don't you see?" Hermione breathed. "If she could have done one thing to make absolutely sure that every single person in the school will read your interview, it was banning it."
And it seemed that Hermione was quite right. By the end of that day, though Harry had not seen so much as a corner of the Quibbler anywhere in the school, the whole place seemed to be quoting the interview at each other. Harry heard them whispering about it as they queued up outside classes, discussing it over lunch and in the back of lessons, while Hermione even reported that every occupant of the cubicles in the girls' toilets had been talking about it when she nipped in there before Ancient Runes.
"And then they spotted me, and obviously they know I know you, so they were bombarding me with questions," Hermione told Harry, her eyes shining. "And Harry, I think they believed you. I really do. I think you finally got them convinced."
Meanwhile, Professor Umbridge was stalking the school, stopping students at random and demanding that they turn out their books and pockets. Harry knew she was looking for copies of the Quibbler, but the students were several steps ahead of her. The pages carrying Harry's interview had been bewitched to resemble extracts from textbooks if anyone but themselves read it, or else wiped magically blank until they wanted to peruse it again. Soon it seemed that every single person in the school had read it. The teachers were, of course, forbidden from mentioning the interview by Educational Decree No. 26, but they found ways to express their feelings about it all the same. Professor Sprout awarded Gryffindor 20 points when Harry passed her a watering can. A beaming Professor Flitwick pressed a box of squeaking sugar mice on him at the end of charms, said "shh," and hurried away. And Professor Trelawney broke into hysterical sobs during divination and announced to the startled class and a very disapproving Umbridge that Harry was not going to suffer an early death after all, but would live to a ripe old age, become Minister of Magic, and have 12 children. But what made Harry happiest was Cho catching up with him as he was hurrying along to Transfiguration the next day. Before he knew what had happened, her hand was in his, and she was breathing in his ear.
"I'm really, really sorry. That interview was so brave. It made me cry."
He was sorry to hear she had shed even more tears over it, but very glad they were on speaking terms again, and even more pleased when she gave him a swift kiss on the cheek and hurried off again. And, unbelievably, no sooner had he arrived outside Transfiguration than something just as good happened. Seamus stepped out of the queue to face him.
"I just wanted to see,"
he mumbled, squinting at Harry's left knee.
"I believe you, and I've sent a copy of that magazine to me, ma'am."
If anything more was needed to complete Harry's happiness, it was Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle's reactions. He saw them with their heads together later that afternoon in the library, together with a weedy-looking boy Hermione whispered was called Theodore Knott. They looked around at Harry as he browsed the shelves for the book he needed on partial vanishment, and Goyle cracked his knuckles threateningly, and Malfoy whispered something undoubtedly malevolent to Crabbe. Harry knew perfectly well why they were acting like this. He had named all of their fathers as Death Eaters.
And the best bit is,
whispered Hermione gleefully as they left the library,
they can't contradict you, because they can't admit they've read the article.
To cap it all, Luna told him over dinner that no copy of The Quibbler had ever sold out faster.
Dad's reprinting,
she told Harry, her eyes popping excitedly.
He can't believe it. He says people seem even more interested in this than the crumpled horned Snorkax.
Harry was a hero in the Gryffindor common room that night. Daringly, Fred and George had put an enlargement charm on the front cover of The Quibbler and hung it on the wall so that Harry's giant head gazed down upon the proceedings, occasionally saying things like, "The Ministry are morons," and "Eat dung, Umbridge," in a booming voice. Hermione did not find this very amusing. She said it interfered with her concentration and ended up going to bed early out of irritation. Harry had to admit that the poster was not quite as funny after an hour or two, especially when the talking spell had started to wear off, so that it merely shouted disconnected words like dung and umbrage at more and more frequent intervals in a progressively higher voice. In fact, it started to make his head ache and his scar began prickling uncomfortably again. To disappointed moans from the many people who were sitting around him, asking him to relive his interview for the umpteenth time, he announced that he too needed an early night. The dormitory was empty when he reached it. He rested his forehead for a moment against the cool glass of the window beside his bed. It felt soothing against his scar. Then he undressed and got into bed, wishing his headache would go away. He also felt slightly sick. He rolled over onto his side, closed his eyes, and fell asleep almost at once. He was standing in a dark, curtained room lit by a single branch of candles. His hands were clenched on the back of a chair in front of him. They were long-fingered and white, as though they had not seen sunlight for years, and looked like large, pale spiders against the dark velvet of the chair. Beyond the chair, in a pool of light cast upon the floor by the candles, knelt a man in black robes.
"I have been badly advised, it seems,"
said Harry, in a high, cold voice that pulsed with anger.
"Master, I crave your pardon,"
croaked the man kneeling on the floor. The back of his head glimmered in the candlelight. He seemed to be trembling.
"I do not blame you, Rookwood,"
said Harry in that cold, cruel voice. He relinquished his grip upon the chair and walked around it, closer to the man cowering upon the floor, until he stood directly over him in the darkness, looking down from a far greater height than usual.
"You are sure of your facts, Rookwood?"
asked Harry.
"Yes, my lord, yes. I used to work in the department after all."
"Avery told me Bode would be able to remove it."
"Bode could never have taken it, master. Bode would have known he could not. Undoubtedly, that is why he fought so hard against Malfoy's imperious curse."
"Stand up, Rookwood,"
whispered Harry. The kneeling man almost fell over in his haste to obey. His face was pockmarked. The scars were thrown into relief by the candlelight. He remained a little stooped when standing, as though halfway through a bow, and he darted terrified looks up at Harry's face.
"You have done well to tell me this,"
said Harry.
"Very well. I have wasted months on fruitless schemes, it seems. But no matter, we begin again from now. You have Lord Voldemort's gratitude, Rookwood."
"My lord, yes, my lord,"
gasped Rookwood, his voice hoarse with relief.
"I shall need your help. I shall need all the information you can give me."
"Of course, my lord, of course. Anything."
"Very well, you may go. Send Avery to me."
Rookwood scurried backward, bowing, and disappeared through a door. Left alone in the dark room, Harry turned toward the wall. A cracked, age-spotted mirror hung on the wall in the shadows. Harry moved toward it. His reflection grew larger and clearer in the darkness. A face whiter than a skull, red eyes with slits for pupils.
"No!"
"What?" yelled a voice nearby. Harry flailed around madly, became entangled in the hangings, and fell out of his bed. For a few seconds he did not know where he was. He was convinced that he was about to see the white, skull-like face looming at him out of the dark again. Then Ron's voice spoke very near to him.
"Will you stop acting like a maniac and I can get you out of here?"
Ron wrenched the hangings apart, and Harry stared up at him in the moonlight, as he lay flat on his back, his scar searing with pain. Ron looked as though he had just been getting ready for bed. One arm was out of his robes.
"Has someone been attacked again?"
asked Ron, pulling Harry roughly to his feet.
"Is it Dad? Is it that snake?"
"No, everyone's fine," gasped Harry, whose forehead felt as though it was on fire again.
"Well, Avery isn't. He's in trouble. He gave him the wrong information. He's really angry."
Harry groaned and sank shaking onto his bed, rubbing his scar. "But Rookwood's going to help him now. He's on the right track again."
"What are you talking about?"
said Ron, sounding scared.
"Do you mean, did you just see you-know-who?"
"I was you-know-who," said Harry, and he stretched out his hands in the darkness and held them up to his face to check that they were no longer deathly white and long-fingered. "He was with Rookwood. He's one of the Death Eaters who escaped from Azkaban, remember? Rookwood's just told him Bode couldn't have done it."
"Done what?"
"Remove something. He said Bode would have known he couldn't have done it. Bode was under the Imperius curse.
I think he said Malfoy's dad put it on him." "Bode was bewitched to remove something,"
Ron said.
"But, Harry, that's got to be..."
"The weapon," Harry finished the sentence for him.
"I know."
The dormitory door opened. Dean and Seamus came in. Harry swung his legs back into bed. He did not want to look as though anything odd had just happened, seeing as Seamus had only just stopped thinking Harry was a nutter.
"Did you say..."
murmured Ron, putting his head close to Harry's on the pretense of helping himself to water from the jug on his bedside table.
"That you were you-know-who?"
"Yeah," said Harry quietly. Ron took an unnecessarily large gulp of water. Harry saw it spill over his chin onto his chest.
"Harry,"
he said, as Dean and Seamus clattered around noisily, pulling off their robes and talking.
"You've got to tell..."
"I haven't got to tell anyone," said Harry shortly. "I wouldn't have seen it at all if I could do occlumency. I'm supposed to have learnt to shut this stuff out. That's what they want." By they, he meant Dumbledore. He got back into bed and rolled over onto his side with his back to Ron, and after a while he heard Ron's mattress creak as he lay back down too. His scar began to burn. He bit hard on his pillow to stop himself making a noise. Somewhere he knew Avery was being punished. Harry and Ron waited until break next morning to tell Hermione exactly what had happened. They wanted to be absolutely sure they could not be overheard. Standing in their usual corner of the cool and breezy courtyard, Harry told her every detail of the dream he could remember. When he had finished, she said nothing at all for a few moments, but stared with a kind of painful intensity at Fred and George, who were both headless and selling their magical hats from under their cloaks on the other side of the yard.
"So that's why they killed him,"
she said quietly, withdrawing her gaze from Fred and George at last.
"When Bode tried to steal this weapon, something funny happened to him. I think there must be defensive spells on it, or around it, to stop people from touching it. That's why he was instant Mungo's. His brain had gone all funny and he couldn't talk. But remember what the healer told us? He was recovering, and they couldn't risk him getting better, could they? I mean, the shock of whatever happened when he touched that weapon probably made the Imperius curse lift. Once he'd got his voice back, he'd explain what he'd been doing, wouldn't he? They would have known he'd been sent to steal the weapon. Of course, it would have been easy for Lucius Malfoy to put the curse on him. Never out of the ministry, is he?"
"He was even hanging around that day I had my hearing," said Harry. "In the..."
"Hang on," he said slowly.
"He was in the Department of Mysteries corridor that day. Your dad said he was probably trying to sneak down and find out what happened in my hearing. But what if..."
"Sturgis!"
gasped Hermione, looking thunderstruck.
"Sorry?"
said Ron, looking bewildered.
"Sturgis Podmore," said Hermione breathlessly. "Arrested for trying to get through a door. Lucius Malfoy got him too. I bet he did it the day you saw him there, Harry. Sturgis had Moody's invisibility cloak, right? So, what if he was standing guard by the door, invisible, and Malfoy heard him move, or guessed he was there, or just did the Imperius curse on the off chance that a guard was there? So when Sturgis next had an opportunity, probably when it was his turn on guard duty again, he tried to get into the department to steal the weapon for Voldemort.
Ron, be quiet.
But he got caught and sent to Azkaban."
She gazed at Harry.
"And now Rookwood's told Voldemort how to get the weapon?"
I didn't hear all the conversation, but that's what it sounded like, said Harry. Rookwood used to work there. Maybe Voldemort'll send Rookwood to do it? Hermione nodded, apparently still lost in thought. Then, quite abruptly, she said, But you shouldn't have seen this at all, Harry.
What? He said, taken aback.
You're supposed to be learning how to close your mind to this sort of thing, said Hermione, suddenly stern.
I know I am, said Harry, but...
Well, I think we should just try and forget what you saw, said Hermione firmly. And you ought to put in a bit more effort on your occlumency from now on.
Harry was so angry with her that he did not talk to her for the rest of the day, which proved to be another bad one. When people were not discussing the escaped Death Eaters in the corridors today, they were laughing at Gryffindor's abysmal performance in their match against Hufflepuff. The Slytherins were singing Weasley is our king so loudly and frequently that by sundown Filch had banned it from the corridors out of sheer irritation. The week did not improve as it progressed. Harry received 2 more D's in potions, was still on tenterhooks that Hagrid might get the sack, and could not stop himself from dwelling on the dream in which he had seen Voldemort, though he did not bring it up with Ron and Hermione again, because he did not want another telling off from Hermione. He wished very much that he could have talked to Sirius about it, but that was out of the question, so he tried to push the matter to the back of his mind. Unfortunately, the back of his mind was no longer the secure place it had once been.
Get up, Potter!
A couple of weeks after his dream of Rookwood, Harry was to be found yet again, kneeling on the floor of Snape's office, trying to clear his head. He had just been forced yet again to relive a stream of very early memories he had not even realized he still had, most of them concerning humiliations Dudley and his gang had inflicted upon him in primary school.
"That last memory," said Snape. "What was it?"
"I don't know," said Harry, getting wearily to his feet.
He was finding it increasingly difficult to disentangle separate memories from the rush of images and sound that Snape kept calling forth.
You mean the one where my cousin tried to make me stand in the toilet?
No, said Snape softly. I mean the one concerning a man kneeling in the middle of a darkened room.
It's nothing, said Harry.
Snape's dark eyes bored into Harry's. Remembering what Snape had said about eye contact being crucial in legitimacy, Harry blinked and looked away.
How do that man and that room come to be inside your head, Potter? Said Snape.
It, said Harry, looking everywhere but at Snape, it was just a dream I had.
A dream,
repeated Snape. There was a pause during which Harry stared fixedly at a large dead frog suspended in a purple liquid in its jar.
You do know why we are here, don't you, Potter?
Said Snape, in a low, dangerous voice.
You do know why I am giving up my evenings to this tedious job?
Yes, said Harry stiffly.
Remind me why we are here, Potter.
So I can learn occlumency, said Harry, now glaring at a dead eel.
Correct, Potter. And dim though you may be,
Harry looked back at Snape, hating him.
I would have thought that after 2 months' worth of lessons, you might have made some progress. How many other dreams about the Dark Lord have you had?
Just that one, lied Harry.
Perhaps, said Snape, his dark, cold eyes narrowing slightly. Perhaps you actually enjoy having these visions and dreams, Potter. Maybe they make you feel special, important?
No, they don't. Said Harry, his jaw set and his fingers clenched tightly around the handle of his wand.
That is just as well, Potter, said Snape coldly, because you are neither special nor important, and it is not up to you to find out what the Dark Lord is saying to his Death Eaters.
No, that's your job, isn't it?
Harry shot at him. He had not meant to say it. It had burst out of him in temper. For a long moment they stared at each other, Harry convinced he had gone too far. But there was a curious, almost satisfied expression on Snape's face when he answered.
Yes, Potter, he said, his eyes glinting. That is my job. Now, if you are ready, we will start again.
He raised his wand.
1, 2, 3, Legilimens!
100 Dementors were swooping toward Harry across the lake in the grounds. He screwed up his face in concentration. They were coming closer. He could see the dark holes beneath their hoods. Yet he could also see Snape standing in front of him, his eyes fixed upon Harry's face, muttering under his breath. And somehow, Snape was growing clearer, and the Dementors were growing fainter. Harry raised his own wand. Protego! Snape staggered. His wand flew upward away from Harry, and suddenly Harry's mind was teeming with memories that were not his. A hook-nosed man was shouting at a cowering woman, while a small dark-haired boy cried in a corner. A greasy-haired teenager sat alone in a dark bedroom, pointing his wand at the ceiling, shooting down flies. A girl was laughing as a scrawny boy tried to mount a bucking broomstick. Enough! Harry felt as though he had been pushed hard in the chest. He took several staggering steps backward, hit some of the shelves covering Snape's walls, and heard something crack. Snape was shaking slightly, very white in the face. The back of Harry's robes were damp. One of the jars behind him had broken when he fell against it. The pickled, slimy thing within was swirling in its draining potion.
Reparo!
Hissed Snape, and the jar sealed itself once more.
Well, Potter, that was certainly an improvement.
Panting slightly, Snape straightened the pensive in which he had again stored some of his thoughts before starting the lesson, almost as though checking that they were still there.
I don't remember telling you to use a shield charm, but there is no doubt that it was effective.
Harry did not speak. He felt that to say anything might be dangerous. He was sure he had just broken into Snape's memories, that he had just seen scenes from Snape's childhood, and it was unnerving to think that the crying little boy who had watched his parents shouting was actually standing in front of him with such loathing in his eyes.
"Let's try again, shall we?"
said Snape. Harry felt a thrill of dread. He was about to pay for what had just happened, he was sure of it. They moved back into position with a desk between them, Harry feeling he was going to find it much harder to empty his mind this time.
"On the count of three, then," said Snape, raising his wand once more. "One, two."
Harry did not have time to gather himself together and attempt to clear his mind, for Snape had already cried,
"Legilimens!"
He was hurtling along the corridor toward the Department of Mysteries, past the blank stone walls, past the torches. The plain black door was growing ever larger. He was moving so fast he was going to collide with it. He was feet from it, and he could see that chink of faint blue light again. The door had flown open. He was through it at last, inside a black-walled, black-floored circular room, lit with blue-flamed candles, and there were more doors all around him. He needed to go on, but which door ought he to take?
Potter!
Harry opened his eyes. He was flat on his back again, with no memory of having gotten there. He was also panting as though he really had run the length of the Department of Mysteries corridor, really had sprinted through the black door and found the circular room.
"Explain yourself,"
said Snape, who was standing over him, looking furious.
"I don't know what happened,"
said Harry, truthfully standing up. There was a lump on the back of his head from where he had hit the ground, and he felt feverish.
"I've never seen that before. I mean, I told you I've dreamed about the door, but it's never opened before." "You are not working hard enough."
For some reason, Snape seemed even angrier than he had done 2 minutes before, when Harry had seen into his own memories.
"You are lazy and sloppy, Potter. It is small wonder that the Dark Lord..."
"Can you tell me something, sir?" said Harry, firing up again. "Why do you call Voldemort the Dark Lord? I've only ever heard Death Eaters call him that." Snape opened his mouth in a snarl, and a woman screamed from somewhere outside the room. Snape's head jerked upward. He was gazing at the ceiling.
"What the?"
he muttered. Harry could hear a muffled commotion coming from what he thought might be the entrance hall. Snape looked around at him, frowning.
"Did you see anything unusual on your way down here, Potter?"
Harry shook his head. Somewhere above them the woman screamed again. Snape strode to his office door, his wand still held at the ready, and swept out of sight. Harry hesitated for a moment, then followed. The screams were indeed coming from the entrance hall. They grew louder as Harry ran toward the stone steps leading up from the dungeons. When he reached the top, he found the entrance hall packed. Students had come flooding out of the great hall, where dinner was still in progress, to see what was going on. Others had crammed themselves onto the marble staircase. Harry pushed forward through a knot of tall Slytherins and saw that the onlookers had formed a great ring, some of them looking shocked, others even frightened. Professor McGonagall was directly opposite Harry on the other side of the hall. She looked as though what she was watching made her feel faintly sick. Professor Trelawney was standing in the middle of the entrance hall with her wand in one hand and an empty sherry bottle in the other, looking utterly mad. Her hair was sticking up on end. Her glasses were lopsided,